This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Good in the Hood returns to celebrate its 20th year, June 20th through the 30th. Good in the Hood is a multicultural music and food festival featuring a parade, information village, kids space, arts and crafts, and an ethnic marketplace. Saturday, June 29th, Good in the Hood will be at Lillis Albina Park in North Portland with music, and KBOO will broadcast live from the park from 2 to 7 p.m. More information about this KBOO-sponsored event may be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
Active Listening with the Seamstress of Sound airs on the second and fourth Thursdays of the month from 10 to midnight. From hip-hop to folk rhythms, the seamstress spins a soulful melody sure to keep you active. Check out Active Listening on the second and fourth Thursdays of the month from 10 to midnight on KBOO.
Our relationship seemingly falling apart at the seams, but our grandmothers were both seamstresses for a reason.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, also heard around the web at www.kboo.fm. Up next is the KBOO Evening News. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Yellow Pages, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit pdxgyp.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a solidarity event with prisoners fighting the deteriorating conditions at Californian prison Pelican Bay will be held tonight in Portland.
The Oregon State Senate approved the budget for K-12 education.
And hundreds have taken to the streets of Portland in celebration of the U.S. Supreme Court's defeat of the Defense of Marriage Act.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, June 26th, 2013. I'm Nat Parker.
And I'm Nia Lewis. A group of California prisoners who went on hunger strike 2 years ago have announced that they will resume their hunger strike on July 1st as conditions at the Pelican Bay State Prison continue to deteriorate. In Portland, a solidarity event will be held tonight at the Red and Black Cafe at Southeast 12th and Oak Street. For more, KBOO's Jenka Soderberg spoke with Pierre Mayo, one of the organizers of tonight's event.
I wonder if you could begin by telling us about the current situation at Pelican Bay and why the prisoners have decided to begin a new hunger strike in July.
Well, the current situations at Pelican Bay are not optimal by any means. There were hunger strikes in 2011, and we saw some more solidarity and hunger actions in 2012. People might ask, why is there another hunger strike, if you will? This is actually a continuation of the demands that we had earlier, which have not been met. If you're interested in the demands, there's five core demands that we don't feel that the system is meeting, and we're taking actions to see that they are met. So that's basically the situation that's going on right now in the prison system, particularly at Pelican Bay.
And what are those demands? I know that the original hunger strike involved the secure housing units, the control units in which people were put into solitary confinement for extended periods of time.
The five demands are, the first demand is we want to end group punishment and administrative abuse. The second demand that we have is abolish the debriefing policy and modify gang status criteria. The third demand is comply with U.S. Commission recommendations to end long-term confinement. The fourth demand is to provide adequate and nutritious food. And the fifth is to create and expand constructive programming. So these demands, like they might sound like technical terms, but basically we want to, this is a human rights issue that we're dealing with here, where we have people that are being confined for extended periods of time. Some people decades, where they're being cut off from communication with all other people. They're kept in very tiny places in solitary confinement, so they don't even have, like, even they don't even see other prisoners. They're just all by themselves, and sometimes they will get out for an hour a day. So out of 23 hours, they have 1 hour, and they're put in another small area devoid of any human contact.
That was Pierre Mayo, who is organizing an event this evening at 7 p.m. at the Red and Black Cafe in Southeast Portland. The event will include music and speakers supporting the prisoners at Pelican Bay State Prison in California, who plan to go on hunger strike beginning in July 1st.
In the Oregon House of Representatives today, a bill which provides incentives for companies and individuals to switch to natural gas passed overwhelmingly, with just three Republicans voting against it. The bill directs the Oregon Public Utility Commission to establish a voluntary emission reduction program. Legislators hope that by providing incentives to switch to natural gas, the state's overall greenhouse gas emission can be reduced. Representative Cliff Bentz led the discussion on the matter.
Don't know how many of you filled up your tank recently. I do quite often when I drive back and forth to Ontario, and I noticed that the price of fuel is around $4 a gallon. If we had natural gas or propane more readily available, the cost would be closer to $2 a gallon. $2 a gallon. How many of us can remember when the price was $2 a gallon? So this bill is consistent with a number of bills we've worked on over the past 5 or 6 years. The hope is to have compressed natural gas, propane, and other alternative fuels available at your local service station. How do we get them there? They're expensive. This bill will assist in placing these alternative fuels at the pump, hopefully helping out local purveyors of fuel, at the same time making fuel more readily available, and hopefully encouraging competition and lower prices. I urge your vote.
Thank you, Representative. Further discussion. Representative Thatcher.
A pop quiz to the carrier, please.
Oh, question of the carrier. Does the carrier yield?
I do.
He does.
Thank you, and I appreciate it. I just came up, and I was just trying to find in here, okay, the term incentive is used quite a bit, incentivizing these projects, and that the commission would be setting up a two-tiered process, and upon approval, some sort of incentive would be provided. I'm trying to figure out, what is the incentive? Where does it come from? Who's paying for it?
Thank you, Representative. Section 8A of the bill, Section 2, excuse me, 8A, limits rate recovery to customers who will benefit from the project. So there, within the service territory, the Public Utility Commission can designate the entities that will be directly benefiting from that and then can grant them rate approval subject to a limit under the statute.
That was testimony from today's session of the Oregon House of Representatives. The bill, which passed the House, provides incentives to public utilities that furnish natural gas to invest in projects that reduce emissions and providing benefits to customers of public utilities that furnish natural gas.
The Oregon State Senate has approved the state budget for K through 12 schools after a back and forth between Republicans and Democrats that lasted for weeks and threatened to draw out the legislative session into an extension beyond next week. Today's passage of the school budget followed the passage earlier this week of the budget for Oregon universities and community colleges on Monday. That budget increased community college funding about $20 million. But the increased amount is not enough to cancel tuition hikes that the State Board of Higher Education approved last Friday. University of Oregon students face a 5% increase in tuition. Oregon State University students face a 6% increase. According to the chancellor of the Oregon University system, if an additional $50 million is added to the budget, it would be enough to cancel the proposed tuition increases. Lawmakers are still able to adjust some budget numbers before the final state budget is passed this week or next. The approved budget does cancel out some increases in fees at Chemeketi Community College. It also saves state-run programs like the OSU County-based Extension Services and provides additional money for school operations departments. The school budget now heads to the desk of Governor John Kitzhaber for approval.
During the latest Baker City School Board meeting, board members voted unanimously to approve the next term's proposed budget, which totaled just under $25 million. At the same meeting, Director Kyle Knight voted against the proposed administrator and teacher evaluation protocol because it was not linked to salary increases. The new protocol was developed in light of requirements under Senate Bill 290, which mandates that school board districts, quote, include core teaching standards for all evaluations of teachers and administrators. Under the new Senate bill, evaluations must be tied to student performance, specifically through test results.
A new survey from the American Association of Retired Persons in Oregon A new survey from the American Association of Retired Persons in Oregon revealed that more than half of Oregonians approaching retirement don't have a savings plan. For more, we go to KBOO's Nicole Betancourt in collaboration with the Oregon News Service.
Oregonians approaching retirement age aren't ready financially. That's the finding in a new survey from AARP Oregon. Among the findings, more than half of residents 45 to 64 don't have a savings plan at work, and 60% would like to see a state-run option. The Oregon House passed a bill on Monday that would create a task force to study ways to help folks save more for their golden years. AARP Oregon Interim State Director Joyce DeMonin says the survey also found that 1 in 6 have less than $5,000 in their retirement account.
And there is no way that that is even getting close to how much a person should be saving each year, let alone your total savings. It's a real problem.
Local chambers of commerce are opposing the bill, objecting to the possibility that the task force might be a step towards creating a state-run retirement plan for private sector employees, claiming that it's not necessary and too much of a state liability. DeMonning says the survey discovered that more than half of Oregonians don't have access to a retirement plan through their workplaces. DeMonning points out that when seniors don't have enough in the bank, it becomes a large liability, not only for the state.
Half of our retirees don't have enough money to live on for more than a year or two. How is that going to impact small business? How is that going to impact local services? How is that going to impact state services? We just can't ignore this as something that's someone else's problem.
The bill that would create a task force is supported by Governor John Kitzhaber and Treasurer Ted Wheeler. For KBOO News, I'm Nicole Betancourt.
The Oregon Health Authority recently gave the Center for Natural Medicine in Portland credentials as a patient-centered primary care home. The center is the first naturopathic clinic in the U.S. to receive the credential as a patient-centered primary care home. Oregon delivers Medicaid through coordinated care organizations in the state, which are now considering credentials for naturopaths as primary care providers. Roughly 200,000 more people will be added to the Medicaid rolls in January when the Affordable Care Act comes into effect and the statewide program expands. In the wake of the Affordable Care Act, the country will be watching closely as Oregon leads the way with this new healthcare model that aims to optimize wellness and decrease costs.
Monsanto representatives are suggesting that the genetically modified wheat found in a field in Oregon last month was planted as an act of sabotage. Monsanto's executive vice president, Rob Fraley, said because the genetically modified wheat was not growing evenly throughout the field, it appeared to be a deliberate plant. The Department of Agriculture is investigating the matter and claims that this is the only such case found in the United States. Genetically modified wheat of the variety found in the Monsanto field is not approved for growing in this country. Japan, Taiwan, and Korea have all stopped importing wheat from the Pacific Northwest as of last month when the genetically modified plants were discovered.
Tree sitters, blockaders, and the support crew have found their new home near the headwaters of Myrtle Creek on ONC land in the White Castle timber sale. They're defending 77 acres of native, never-before-logged forest from variable retention harvest, also known as clear-cutting. The White Castle timber sale contains lush native and old-growth trees punctuated by flowering rhododendrons, trilliums, and wild iris among salal and Oregon grape. It is considered habitat for five pairs of endangered spotted owls, three fens, and rare forest wetlands. The tree sit was discovered by Bureau of Land Management, or BLM, surveyors on June 13th. Law enforcement officers from both the BLM and Douglas County Sheriff's Office have visited the site every day since, but there have been no arrests and no reported closures on the timber sale unit. Forest ecologist Norm Johnson visited the site and tried to defend the clear-cutting of the tree sit of the tree stand to the protesters.
It's certainly a significant issue on whether or not we should log this stand. And it is, by far, the most controversial.
Do you think we should be logging native forests at all?
Well, I don't. As I've said, at least for these diverse release sorrel, it primarily should come from the previously harvested stand. Does that mean we never cut a native forest stand again? I'm not in a position to say that.
Why? You're the expert. Should we be logging native forests at all?
I'm not going to be put under an inquisition, okay, by you or anyone else. So just be clear about that.
I'm asking you. I think this is an extremely reasonable question. You are one of the primary forest experts in this region, if not the world, on what we're talking about. I don't think it's inquisitive or harassing to ask you if you think we should be logging native forests. This is a serious issue. It's almost gone. It can't be replaced. And we know what happens when it's gone.
And I've given you the best answer I can.
I tell you, I feel like you don't like us coming and saying your projects are clear cuts and like we have a problem with them. We're going to keep doing it, man.
That was ecologist Norm Johnson speaking to protesters at the White Castle timber sale. This tree sit is part of an ongoing campaign against the Oregon and California revested grant lands that are currently being sought after by the timber industry in the name of science and economic growth.
The Supreme Court ruled the Defense of Marriage Act unconstitutional today. The decision entitles legally married same-sex couples to the same federal benefits as heterosexual couples. These include tax, health, and retirement benefits in addition to family visitation rights. In the same session, the court ruled that the proponents of California's same-sex marriage ban have no authority to defend the ban in federal court. This clears the way for legal same-sex marriage to resume in California in the next month. Today's ruling did not address whether there is a constitutional right to gay marriage, leaving this larger issue for individual states to decide. Once California overturns its ban, 13 states will allow same-sex marriage.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for free speech radio news after this newscast, followed by The Underground at 6, hosted by the Youth Collective, focusing on issues facing American youth such as activism, school, and local events. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather is cloudy with a 30% chance of showers, mostly in the morning, and a high temperature of 78 degrees.
It's 5:19 in the Post Meridian. Time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Step right up, folks, and take your chances in the amazing new American workplace. Constantly high unemployment, low wages always, no employee bargaining power, a corporate paradise. This paradise has enriched the already rich investor elite and rewarded top executives with multimillion-dollar pay packages. It also lets corporations treat the masses of people in today's workforce like Kleenexes. Just use them up and toss them. After all, they're cheap, plentiful, and disposable. Indeed, taskmasters in suits have now redefined the term hired to mean that you're tethered to a corporation full-time, but you actually work and get paid for only the few hours a week when the boss calls. This nefarious practice, known as on-call shifts, is all the rage among national retail chains. Such giants as Abercrombie and Fitch, Gap, and Urban Outfitters require employees to work without set schedules and to be available to have their string yanked at any time, day or night, even on weekends, with as little as 2 hours' notice. Likewise, if customer traffic in a store is slow, retail workers who got dressed up, battled the morning commute, and reported on time can simply be sent away after an hour or so, with no pay for their lost hours. A recent survey of some 400 retail employees in New York City found that only 17% have a set schedule. Those with no set hours also have no set income and no life. If you're at the beck and call of the boss, what do you do with your children? How do you make a doctor's appointment? What if you're taking a class or trying to work a second job? This is Jim Hightower saying, this shameful on-call practice says that the corporation owns you and that abuse of workers is a legitimate business practice in America. To help stop it, contact retailactionproject.org.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
The Economic Policy Institute plans to host a teleconference Friday morning to enhance awareness about the impact of income inequality and plug their new interactive website, inequality.us. The think tank's founder, Lawrence Michel, and former laborer Robert Reich will be on hand to take questions from the press about both causes and potential remedies. KBOO's Robin Ryan spoke with EPI's Elise Gould, Director of Health Policy Research, about the conference call, the website, and the organization's ideas on how to return economic opportunity to the hands of everyday people.
Tell me about why your organization chose to launch this site and what you were hoping to accomplish when you did.
We launched this new website, inequality.is, to try to bring the breadth of our research and the depth of our research on inequality to everyday people so that everyday people can understand or better understand how inequality affects their daily lives. Here at the Economic Policy Institute, we've been studying economic inequality for over 25 years. And what we thought was that people understand that there's been growing inequality in the U.S. They understand that over the last 30 years, the kind of growth that we've seen in the United States has been vastly unequal. But what I think that they don't understand is how it affects them and how it affects their lives. If economic growth had grown strongly and equally over the last 30 years, the wages that people would be taking home, the income that they would be making, the wealth that they would have accumulated would look very different today than it does.
Your organization is going to be hosting a teleconference on Friday.
We will be talking, Larry Michel, the president of EPI, and Robert Reich, former Secretary of Labor, will be on that call to discuss the new website and inequality generally.
I want you to talk about the causes of income inequality and how you see the form of the most expedient remedies.
So what we've seen is we've seen unequal growth over the last 30 years. And what does that unequal growth look like is if we look at the bottom of the spectrum, the bottom of the distribution of wages, those who have the lowest wages, we've seen that the minimum wage has been losing value over many, many years. And that's one thing that we can do to fix it is to have the minimum wage targeted better to make sure that people's productivity is reflected in the wages that they get. Another thing we've seen over the last 30 years, we've seen a decline in unionization, even though many, many people who are not unionized would like to have a union, would like to have collective bargaining. And what's happened as the productivity growth that we've seen has not been reflected in workers' wages, they just haven't had the bargaining power, and unions would help substantially with that bargaining power. What else have we seen? We've seen that the taxes on the very top have dropped significantly over the last 30, 40 years. And what that means is that those at the top have a much greater incentive to have, if they're going to get, let's say, 70 cents on the dollar, it's going to be very different for them in terms of thinking about getting all of that back in wages if they get to keep so much of it. And so that's led to the rise of that top 1% taking home more and more of the gains of the economy. There's this idea that the American dream is alive and well, and that anybody has a chance to get into the top 1%. It's simply not the case. If you were born poor with poor parents, you're much more likely to be poor as an adult. And those that are going to enter the top 1% are much more likely to come from the top of the income distribution. It's saying that it's okay to have so much inequality because everyone has a shot is simply not true. And in fact, we're far less mobile than many of our peer countries.
For KBOO News, this is Robin Ryan.
Announced a series of executive initiatives designed to combat the rapidly growing threat of climate change in a speech in Washington, D.C. Obama specifically mentioned the Keystone XL pipeline, which, if completed, will move massive amounts of tar sands oil from Alberta to the Gulf of Mexico. Obama said that the, quote, net effects of the pipeline's impacts on our climate will be absolutely critical to determining whether the project will go forward, end quote. Tar Sands Blockade, a grassroots organization determined to stop the Keystone XL pipeline from being constructed, said in a statement that it is an organization was not satisfied with the president's comments. KBOO's Ben Renner spoke with Ron Seifert, a spokesperson for Keystone Blockade, who outlined his organization's grievances.
Well, it's encouraging to hear the president voice his intentions to address climate change and the Keystone XL's climate impacts. We at the Blockade are certainly not holding our breath. After all, this is the same president that fast-tracked the southern segment of the pipeline to pump these toxic tar sands right through Texas and Oklahoma communities. We all know that construction of the pipeline is going to open the floodgates to the largest carbon pool in North America. And we're going to continue to organize and work together to connect our struggles against the root causes of climate crisis. The short of it is, President Obama, despite his rhetoric, has already sold out the families in Texas and Oklahoma that are going to be directly impacted and whose health and safety are now threatened by construction of this pipeline. He is putting people that want absolutely nothing to do with this pipeline directly in harm's way already. So, of course, resistance will go on, regardless of the president's rhetoric, and we will do everything we can to stop Keystone XL.
That was Ron Seifert of Keystone Blockade. And earlier in this newscast, we shared a story on how the Supreme Court ruled the Defense of Marriage Act unconstitutional today. Our illustrious news director, Jenka Soderberg, is live on the streets of Portland. And Jenka, I'd love for you to describe the scene at Pioneer Square right now.
Well, it's actually a cherry shrunk plaza. It's a very festive atmosphere here, Third Street. In Portland, downtown Portland, there's hundreds of people out here, rainbow balloons, there's families gathered. People are very, very excited about today's decision in the U.S. Supreme Court. And talking about the implications here in Oregon, standing next to me is Michael Smith, one of the organizers with Oregon United for Marriage. He's just a volunteer with Oregon United for Marriage. And Michael, can you tell us your thoughts on today's decision by the Supreme Court?
So that's actually two different questions. I mean, the DOMA decision I thought was fantastic. I was actually a little bit disappointed by the Prop 8 decision. I was hoping that they would do something more expansive that would say replace civil unions with same-sex marriage in every state that has civil unions. Unfortunately, that didn't come to pass. So now we're having to work hard to replace Measure 36, for example, here in Oregon. Just like people like Greg Harris are trying to establish gay marriage in Illinois. It's a fight now that's nationwide, and this just adds new energy to the fight, but there's still a fight.
Well, over a dozen states now have legalized gay marriage. What's the situation here in Oregon, and what are people doing about it?
Okay, so my understanding of the situation, and this, first of all, this is really plain and simple. Just for background, so all of your listeners know, 10 years ago approximately, the voters of the state of Oregon voted to put in the Constitution that marriage is between one man and one woman. That's called Measure 36. Now, what we're trying to do, my understanding is, we're trying to scratch that language and replace it so that the Constitution will say marriage is between two consenting adults. Now, that's my basic understanding of the situation. And what we are trying to do is we are trying to gather signatures to get that started. So July 20th, we are starting to gather signatures. And the kickoff rally is a location to be determined, but it's July 20th at 10 a.m. We're going to start gathering signatures. And all of you that want to help us, go to orunited.org. That's orunited.org, and volunteer and get information and get yourself in the process and get your friends and your neighbors and your church friends in the process and get this started. The fight is on, and we need all hands on deck.
Well, thanks very much. That was Michael Smith, a volunteer with Oregon United for Marriage. Their website, again, orunited.org, and this rally is ongoing right now at Terry Shrunk Plaza in downtown Portland, across from the federal building. Very, very festive atmosphere. People really excited that the Supreme Court made this decision today.
That was Jenka Soderberg of KBOO Community Radio, live downtown, where hundreds have taken to the streets to celebrate the decision.
At 11:18 yesterday morning, Texas State Senator Wendy Davis began an 11-hour filibuster to prevent voting on a bill that would severely limit access to abortions in Texas. The bill would ban abortions after 20 weeks and require clinics to pay for costly upgrades to become classified as surgical centers. Opponents estimate that 37 of the 42 clinics would have to close due to the costly upgrades. Senator Davis read stories of women affected by the issue during her 11-hour testimony. She was not allowed to sit down, leave the Senate floor, or stray off topic during her filibuster. After three sustained objections to her filibuster, twice for straying off topic and once for having a colleague help her with a back brace, she finished speaking at 10 p.m. The midnight deadline to vote on the bill was disrupted by crowds that packed the Senate building. Senator David Dewhurst said, quote, "We had an unruly mob using Occupy Wall Street tactics," end quote. Amid the chaos, Republicans argued that the 19-10 vote had occurred before midnight, while Democrats claimed it had occurred just after the deadline. Finally, at 3 a.m., Dewhurst announced that the vote had not been officially taken before the deadline due to the ruckus. Political analysts predict that Governor Rick Perry will soon call a special session to vote on that bill once again. It is also suspected that the bill is likely to pass during a second session.
Oregon Senator Ron Wyden spoke out today against the National Security Agency's collection of phone call records of American citizens. Wyden has been at the forefront of challenging the NSA's secret collection of emails that was exposed last week and is now speaking out on the massive collection of phone records as well. NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden's recent admission forced NSA surveillance actions into the national headlines several weeks ago. As a result, it has come to public attention that the NSA collects phone records and emails in bulk, including information about personal relationships, medical issues, and religious affiliations. Senator Wyden denounced such practices today at a panel sponsored by the American Society for News Editors, claiming that such far-reaching surveillance is a violation of American civil liberties. Wyden considers this wide-sweeping collection to be unnecessary and suggested that instead of collecting records as a matter of course, the NSA should only collect them in emergency situations or when mandated by a court order. Wyden has been involved in the issue on several levels and recently received an award from the Sunshine in Government Initiative for helping to increase reporters' ability to report on issues like NSA surveillance. He was instrumental in changing the 2012 Intelligence Authorization Act, which had previously prevented intelligence workers from becoming news commentators until a year after their intelligence work. This move is credited with having increased transparency in media discussion of these issues.
Former New England Patriots tight end Aaron Hernandez pled not guilty to first-degree murder and five firearms charges at his arraignment today in an Attleboro district court. According to prosecutors, Hernandez drove his friend Odin Lloyd to an industrial park in the middle of the night and executed him after a dispute at a nightclub three nights earlier. First Assistant District Attorney Bill McCauley said that Hernandez, quote, orchestrated the crime from the beginning and took steps to conceal and destroy evidence, end quote. Lloyd's body was discovered on June 17th by a jogger at an industrial park about 1 mile from Hernandez's home on the Rhode Island state line. Prosecutors cited surveillance footage from Hernandez's house that shows him leaving with a firearm shortly before text messages from Lloyd's phone confirmed that he was picked up by Hernandez and two friends around 2:30 in the morning. 2:30 the morning Lloyd was killed. About an hour after Hernandez picked up Lloyd, employees of the industrial park working an overnight shift heard gunshots. Prosecutors also cited surveillance footage showing the vehicle Hernandez rented traveling to and from the industrial park and Hernandez exiting the vehicle at 3:29 a.m. with a gun. The NFL star's attorney, Michael Fee, said the case was, quote, not strong. Fee asked for bail, but a judge denied the request because of the seriousness of the charges. About 2 hours after Hernandez was arrested, the New England Patriots announced they had released him from the team. Hernandez signed a 5-year contract extension worth $40 million with New England last summer.
Today, on the United Nations International Day in Support of Victims of Torture, a United States district court dismissed a lawsuit charging U.S. military contractors with torturing Iraqi prisoners in Abu Ghraib military prison. The torture scandal came to light when horrific pictures of torture were exposed on the internet in 2006. The lawsuit was filed by the Center for Constitutional Rights on behalf of four Iraqi men who were tortured at Abu Ghraib. The group charged the private U.S.-based contractor CACI Premier Technology, known by its acronym CACI, with participating in torture and other sadistic, blatant, and wanton criminal abuses of detainees at Abu Ghraib. The suit brought claims under the Alien Tort Statute for torture and war crimes. It was the last active case seeking accountability for torture at Abu Ghraib and the last chance for victims of torture to receive justice. In dismissing the lawsuit, the district judge did not deny the victims had been tortured. But the suit was dismissed on a narrow procedural loophole. The Iraqi men who were tortured by U.S. contractors say that they plan to appeal the district court's decision.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Emily Sterling, Jennifer Kemp, Nicole Betancourt, Rusty Crooks, and Robin Ryan. The producer is Ben Renner. Special thanks to the reporters at the Oregon News Service. Our engineer is Sequoia Wright. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. If you'd like to call your elected representatives about any issue you've heard on the news tonight, here are the phone numbers, so get a pen or something to write with. The local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120. You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River 91.9 FM. I'm Nat Parker.
And I'm Nia Lewis. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO, At 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, on Voices from the Edge, host Joanne Hardesty speaks with Dante James of the Office of Equity and Human Rights about what is equity and what is the role of the Office of Equity and Human Rights. At 9, hear Press Watch, news you're not supposed to know, with Teresa Mitchell. At 9:30 on A Deeper Look, host Linda Olson Osterlin speaks with attorney Stephen Downs of Project Salaam about the case of a Muslim man who was targeted by an FBI sting and convicted, but now documents indicate it was a case of mistaken identity. At 10, hear Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, hear Flashpoints with host Dennis Bernstein. At 11 on Between the Covers, host David Naiman interviews No Violet Bulawayo about her new novel, Africa, called We Need New Names. And at 11:30, the film show features news and interviews about the independent film scene in Portland. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not a KBOO member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. And stay tuned now for more national and international news from the worker-run collective at Free Speech Radio News. Have a lovely evening.
This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, June 26, 2013. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for FSRN. The Supreme Court says the federal government must recognize and extend rights to legally married same-sex couples. The court says Section 3 of the Defense of Marriage Act is unconstitutional. The court also issued a decision in the Proposition 8 case that appears to clear the way for same-sex marriage to once again be allowed in California. Today, California Governor Jerry Brown ordered all counties to begin issuing marriage licenses to gay and lesbian couples as soon as the lower court stay is lifted, as ordered by the Supreme Court. We'll have more on both decisions later in the show. Early this morning in Canada, police arrested 20 people who were blockading an oil pipeline pumping station. The action in southern Ontario is associated with the Idle No More movement for Indigenous rights. FSRN's Aaron Lakoff has more.
Last Thursday, a group of demonstrators began occupying part of Enbridge's Line 9 pipeline, locking down the main entrance to the pumping station and preventing employees from gaining access. Enbridge, a large Canadian energy transportation company, plans to reverse the flow of the pipeline so that it can carry oil from the Alberta tar sands through eastern Canada, Vermont, New Hampshire, and Maine. After being arrested, the protesters were charged with trespassing and disobeying court orders. They were released by early afternoon. The action comes after another Enbridge pipeline leaked 750 barrels of oil in northern Alberta last week. The Polaris Institute, an economic justice organization, has estimated there have been more than 800 Enbridge pipeline leaks between 1999 and 2010. Yesterday, solidarity actions with the Line 9 blockade were held in 13 Canadian cities. Protesters are concerned that the pipeline runs through the most populated corridor of Canada, as well as several First Nations reserves. Aaron Lakoff, FSRN, Montreal.
The issue of how and where to dispose of toxic waste left after the 1984 Bhopal gas disaster has been the source of persistent controversy in India. The Union Carbide fertilizer plant still contains tons of industrial waste, and several disposal proposals have already fallen through. The latest plan would see the waste processed in a small town about 100 miles from Bhopal, but local residents are not happy. FSRN's Shuria Niazi reports.
The disposal plant in the central Indian town of Pithampur is beginning trial runs to determine if it will be able to handle toxic waste from Bhopal. If successful, the plant is slated to take 346 tons of contaminated material from the shuttered Union Carbide fertilizer plant. But NGOs, villagers and members of the Madhya Pradesh political opposition are opposing the trials. The organization Lok Maitri says it will protest the incineration of Bhopal waste in Pithampur tomorrow. The NGO says the incineration will adversely affect the environment and health of people residing in the area. The trial run was ordered by the Indian Supreme Court, which asked the state government to complete the tests by mid-July. After receiving the results, the Supreme Court will decide whether to move forward with the disposal of the Bhopal waste. Shurai Niazi, FSRN, Bhopal.
Today, Texas is set to pass a grim milestone, 500 executions since capital punishment was reintroduced in the state in the late 1970s. Death penalty abolitionists are using the occasion to highlight the injustices they see in the criminal justice system. FSRN's Jacob Santillan reports from Houston.
Texas operates the busiest execution chamber in the United States, and today will likely put to death its 500th inmate. Kimberly McCarthy was condemned for the 1997 killing of her neighbor. McCarthy, an African American, was granted two prior reprieves after arguing her jury panel was selected to exclude ethnic minorities. Texas anti-death penalty activist Ray Hill says that jury selection is still tainted by racism and shouldn't be the basis of her execution.
I don't think there's any doubt whether Kimberly McCarthy is guilty or not. I don't think that's the issue. I think the issue is, do we as a society want to have a corrupted jury decision stand without redress?
Kimberly McCarthy is scheduled to be put to death by lethal injection Wednesday evening. Anti-death penalty activists will hold a demonstration outside the execution chamber in Huntsville, Texas. Jacob Santillan, FSRN, Houston.
And that's headlines for FSRN. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
I'm Dorian Marina in Los Angeles. Today, on the final day of its term, the U.S. Supreme Court struck down part of the Defense of Marriage Act as unconstitutional, saying it unfairly discriminated against same-sex couples. Now the federal government must recognize and grant